Is the current global geopolitical climate dictated by which country receives a pair of panda bears? And is that even a new idea? Find out this week on Seemingly Unrelated. All right, everyone, welcome back to Seemingly Unrelated, where we try to find the stories behind those everyday familiar things and trace their unexpected impacts on history, society, and culture. I'm Dr. Andrew Johnstone, lecturer at the University of Glasgow, and as always, I'm joined by producer Naomi. Hello, Naomi.
Hello.
This week, this fortnight, because we don't come out every week, we have a guest that has been in the game for more than a decade of podcasting. He's also a writer, right? And draws comic books. There's I believe, if I remember correctly, directed at least one documentary, if not more than that. It is Chris Mancini. Chris, how are you doing today?
Thanks. Great to be here. Good to reconnect, Andrew. I know it's been a minute since we've spoken, and
it could very well be a decade at this point, but at least since I left the United States.
Indeed. Well, you haven't lost your accent, so there's that.
So, could you please introduce yourself to the audience a bit? Just let them know what do you got going on. Who are you? What's your background, so they can really put themselves in your place.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a writer and a comedian for many years, and I moved into podcasting in about 2009 with Comedy Film Nerds with my partner Graham Elwood, and we started a production company and a podcast that where comedians would talk about movies, and not just comedy movies, but all sorts of movies. And we have about 600 episodes of there, but they are still up. So you can only, if you ever want to get some movie talk, you can grab one. But we ended the show right before COVID hit, when all the movie theaters closed. So we look like geniuses, you saw right when it was right about to happen.
Wow. Yeah.
And then, you know, we sunsetted Comedy Film Nerds. And then in about 2020, I started a new company called White Cat Entertainment, and I wanted to continue with creating content, but focus on what I love the most, telling stories through comic books and podcasts. So we created two podcasts. One of them was The Quiet Journeys of Professor Atwood, which is an anti-anxiety, sleep aid. It's kind of like a hybrid. It's like a sleep story, anti-anxiety. It's adventure, comedy, you know, and all of these things. But it has a nice music and sound design underneath it. So if you're feeling really stressed, which a lot of people in our country are right now, you could you could listen. The other one we do is Conversations from the Abyss, which is like a Twilight Zone episode. I'm working on that next season now. So it's a bunch of short kind of stories that, you know, they're self-contained and they're about 15 minutes long. So basically I promote them as stories to help you sleep and stories to keep you awake. So you can pick which one you want, depending on your mood.
I could vouch, by the way, for Professor Atwood.
Oh, good.
Because I think that for me, folks out there with ADHD, mm-hmm. like I do, a lot of the problem with the sleeping podcast out there is they're boring. And I can't go to sleep because then I'm going to, you know, my brain's going to start making all that. So it's actually something to follow along with. There's actually something to hold on to. But it is, it's like everything you just said. It helps cool everything down. So thumbs up. And we'll have links to those all in the show notes. For all the folks listening, you can go see the White Cat Entertainment suite of media entertainment. So Chris,
that's what I've been up to.
That's what you've been up to. And as I remember, and this is a great moment where Naomi gets to be poised to get ready to take an edit. You've got kids, right, Chris? Am I remembering this correctly? That means I'm going to guess you've had to go to the zoo before. What's your opinion of going to the zoo?
You know what? That's really interesting. I have mixed feelings about a zoo. And one of the reasons is it's like, you know, I don't like to see the animals kind of caged up like that. However, what it does do is create a tremendous educational opportunity for kids, especially underprivileged kids who may never get to see these animals, to learn about them. And it could spark, you know, some educational interest in them. So I think zoos are a mixed bag. Some of them do it better than others, where they have these large environments. Like, I think Disney's Animal Kingdom is a great example of, like, you have a big living zoo where there's all these, they're not tiny cages, they're enclosures where the animals can wander around and all of those things. But it's a mixed thing. If it's done well, it's really positive. If it's done poorly, it's more negative.
Yeah.
I feel like whenever I go to a zoo, I'm like, oh, that's really exciting to go to a zoo. And then I turn up, I'm like, oh, it's actually a bit sad.
So the good news is, this is a modern debate, because if we look at the history of the zoos, it's fucking dark. There's no happiness in that story. So when we look back at the first examples of zoos in history, we do kind of still see the bits of what a zoo is today, but in less pleasant terms. So the oldest example of a zoo is either in Egypt, in 1480 BCE, so just 3,500 years ago, which is Hatshepsut's public exhibit, or if we don't want to count that as a zoo, then Wen Wang's Garden of Intelligence in China also dates back to about 1060 BCE. So kind of depending on what you want to count as a zoo, because in Egypt, Hatshepsut's exhibit was only around for about 6 months, and then they slaughtered all the animals and ate them. whereas Wen Wang's garden.
So from zoo to dinner in, like, you know, one day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in six months, you know, a lot of the animals died of natural causes along the way. Whereas Wen Wang's garden was more of a nature preserve. He actually closed off 1,200 acres in China, and he brought what he thought of as the animals that represented the balance between civilization and the savagery. So like red deer, koi fish, these sort of animals that had organization, like observable organization to them. And his whole thing was, to the rich enough people, come to the garden and observe the animals and get the sense of what it means to be at the balance point between civilized and wild. And are we humans, are we really any different than the red deer? Hatshepsut's was a little bit different. So the points of her exhibit was, so Hatshepsut was the first pharaohess of Egypt. Fun fact about her. She basically put her son in prison so that he couldn't inherit the throne. And she invaded a nearby territory called Punt, which today would be Eritrea.
Hey, I had a question as we're talking about, like, the origins of zoos. Like, when did the actual term zoo, when was it created? Because, like, it sounds like everyone kind of felt like they made the first one. Did they name it something different? Or when did we come to the term zoo?
So the term zoo, and I'm going to double check my notes here. Yeah, right. It is an English term from London from the middle of the 19th century. It comes from the Greek. So, like, zoon? Is that how it's said? I think. But it just means animal. And it's meant to be short for zoology, because it was like London, mid-19th century. We got all these guys saying that they're like naturalists. We got guys saying they're, you know, botanists and whatnot. We're inventing like a lot of the sciences. So zoology was one of them, which just means the study of animals. And then someone said, well, this is the place where we study them, so we call it the zoo. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's when the official term enters the English language. But it's funny, because that, and we'll get to it in a second, that does come about a century or so after the first zoos were actually, like, the modern zoo as we understand were constructed. So I wonder what they called them before that. I didn't I didn't see that in my notes.
They just say, let's go to the place with the animals.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. They're all collected in one place. Yeah.
Yeah. The big animal collection. Thingy. We should come up with a word for that. We'll get right on it. Hatshepsut conquers the country of Punt, which is a great name for a country, which is today Eritrea. She gathers all these animals up and brings them back to Thebes as sort of like a way of demonstrating political power. So to say, like, these are the spoils of war. So it would have been shown, you know, these sort of, there's a lot of monkeys and some lions and some other animals that I guess weren't in Egypt, for whatever reason, but they were in Eritrea. And it really is just a symbol to say, look how badass I am. I am a conqueror of worlds. Come look at these animals. And then, as I said, after about 6 months.
Conquered the koi fish.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The very, very dangerous fish that only lives in a pond and will breed like twice in its life. So it is that duality of zoos is tied into the whole long history of it. Is it a nature preserve or is it a, you know, circus, effectively, which is really what Hatshepsut was trying to do. Now, we talked a bit there about England inventing the term, but England also has another pretty deep connection to the origin of the modern zoo. Before we get to that, Chris, I want to know if the national animal of the United States is an eagle, and the national animal of China is the panda bear, and the national animal of Canada is a beaver. That's true. What is the national animal of England?
I'm going to say a scone.
Correct answer.
except for the fact
the first time.
That you pronounced it scone instead of scone.
It's a scone, but that's fine.
I would absolutely be so mad at you. The lion, of course. The lion is the symbol of England.
Of, you know, Sir Richard.
Yeah.
The Lionheart.
Richard the Lionheart, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, how many lions do you think have been native to England?
Zero.
Correct. There's no lion species native, not even mountain lions, because like California has a native mountain lion species, and the African lion, which is the sort of the Lion King lion that exists in our head, is of course from Africa. But England, no lions until 1235, when King Henry III received a gift from the Holy Roman Emperor, which was three lions. He was gifted three lions, and he didn't know what they were, so he called them leopards. And he was so enamored with these lions that he put it on his heraldry. So all of the monarchs that have descended from Henry III have had a lion in the heraldry, and that's why it's England's special animal. And then Great Britain has its own national animal, which is bulldogs. The English bulldog.
Yeah. Boring.
So what's like lions, dragons, unicorns, bulldog. Fat little flabby dog that can't breathe through its nose because of terrible breathing. So lions arrive in 1235. They're still to this day on the England national football jerseys. That's why there's three lions on there. And Naomi, do you know the song, the Three Lions song?
No. Oh. Is it to do with football? Because
Will in here. Have him come sing the...
My boyfriend literally like works in football and he's had football on the TV all day. I feel like I'm being taunted. And now we're talking about it in the podcast.
Yeah.
I can't escape.
You can't escape. So he was so enamored with these lions, he really wanted people to get a look at him. He wanted to show off his lions because he thought they were so, or his leopards, as he thought they were so great. So he wants to start a menagerie. And of course, he chose that most welcoming, warming, loving place in all of London, the Tower of London.
Yeah.
No, when you think of the Tower of London, Chris, any things that pop into your head?
Yeah, I was thinking, did he take the lions through Traitor's Gate?
Somebody's been on the tour. Yeah, it's the same place that, like, people get executed, right? That's where mm-hmm. Anne Boleyn got her head cut off. Like, it's Richard III kept the two kids who were supposed to be the heirs to the throne in the Tower of London until they died. It also was a zoo from 1235.
I did not know that. I don't remember that from the tour either.
Yep. 1235 until 1806. So wow. It is technically the longest zoo, like longest lasting zoo in the history of the world. No zoo was a zoo for longer than the Tower of London.
I can imagine it being not very spacious as a zoo.
No. It's literally vertical. So
yeah. It's yeah. Like, I can't really imagine where they're keeping the lions.
Yeah.
Which like one courtyard.
I mean, it was a problem for quite a lot of those animals. Like, we'll get into some of the details, but it gets dark really quick. His thinking was that the public get to look. He got more animals, obviously, not just three lions, but could get a look at these animals. Cost of admission was either one, a day's wage. Pretty expensive, or you could just bring a stray dog or cat and give it in to feed the lions.
Wow.
England, what is going on down there? I know it was 800 years ago, but come on, guys.
And you know some of those weren't strays. You're like, oh, I'm so tired of this dog, let's go to the zoo.
100% Someone would be like, that cat has knocked the last fucking glass off of this side of the table. He's going to the zoo. He's going to the Tower of London tomorrow. So this kind of starts spreading around Europe. They get a little excited. People are like, did you hear that Henry has got a menagerie in the Tower of London on display with lions in it? That's pretty cool. And so the kings of Europe started to send animals to England as a diplomatic, like, introduction to both settle peace deals and negotiations with England, but also as a chance to, like, show off their kind of weird exotic animals that they wanted mm-hmm. to have on display. It's like the King of Finland sent a polar bear into the Tower of London, and that polar bear would swim in the Thames every day to go fishing with a collar, like a metal collar with chain that was tied up to the tower. He ate two people during his stint because they went to feed him, and it's a polar bear.
Yeah,
fun fact, don't touch polar bears.
Yeah, and he might, I don't know, be mad that he was had a chain around his neck. I
can't imagine it was comfortable. Also, the Thames, disgusting. Like,
yeah, even back really, then.
Oof. Really gross, especially on that side of London.
France, was it something where they just, like, you know, it was something that was like an animal that was kind of like native to the land, or would they kind of go all out and like, no, I'm going to get something from, like, you know, South Africa or something and really make an impression?
Beautiful segue, Chris. Beautiful segue, because France sent an elephant.
Ah.
And now you may have remembered earlier, both of you were sort of like, guys, not a lot of space in the Tower of London. Yeah, the elephant had to live in a room which it could not move in. It really was just stuck in a room. You could only view it through a window. And it died 2 years after it arrived in what I can only imagine was something along the lines of the living conditions that the Rancor had under Jabba's throne room. Like, just can you imagine the Tower of London? Oh my God. It's just gross and cold and dark.
And everyone's turning up with their cats and dogs so they can get in for free.
I know. Now, was there ever like a movement to, like, you know what, we're going to have this zoo for a while. Maybe the tower isn't the best place. Let's look at somewhere where we could build an actual area to put these animals. That never occurred to anyone back then.
Nope. Not for 600 years. Literally, yeah. until 1806, it was not known. Now, to be fair, about 6 months after the elephant arrived, they had expanded and they sort of made like a courtyard area that had a bit of a covering, which is that trader's gate that was originally that zone was made for the elephant. Mm-hmm. Who died shortly after, and I guess people felt betrayed by that. It is wild. It just keeps going. Like during his reign, like James the First, he started filling with birds because he thought that birds would like better adjust to their living conditions, and that's where like the first parrots arrived in England. Mm. And maybe the first pigeon, but I don't trust that source. I don't trust that. I read it somewhere, I don't buy it.
And now for something completely unrelated. Do you know, have you seen that theory online that pigeons aren't real?
Excuse me?
I have not. No.
People say that like no one's ever seen a pigeon baby. And where all the pigeon babies, they're all just full-grown pigeons all the time. And so they can't be real, and therefore they're invented by the government and they're all robots. It's quite convincing. So maybe you should read that source, Andrew.
They live on the edge of the flat Earth. This is where, that's where they stay.
What do they mean no one has seen a baby pigeon before?
Yeah, everyone's convinced.
Many people have seen baby pigeons.
And you look at the article and you think, you know what? I've never seen a baby pigeon either.
For a second, you're like, I think they have a point.
Do we think it would be helpful for someone like me, not me though, but someone like me to like introduce them to pigeon breeding, which was like the most popular?
Oh, I don't think they want facts. I think you need to show them a baby pigeon. I think you need to...
So a lot of 19th century drawings of baby pigeons aren't going to do the trick, damn it.
No, I don't think so.
No, so they can cut it open and see the gears.
Yeah. They want to see the AI.
They want the camera.
Yeah.
Is it better than the one on my phone? God damn it. So, unsurprisingly... As the time goes forward and every other European country starts to get its zoo in order, as they sort of think, ooh, this is a great idea. Britain goes across the world and the Tower of London becomes like the central location where, oh, we went to New Zealand and we found some like koala bears or something. Bring them back to the Tower of London, and it keeps filling up that building over and over again. And it wasn't until 1752 when someone decided to do a better idea than the Tower of London. The Schönbrunn Zoo in Vienna opened. It is still in operation, so it is the world's oldest zoo, but it was the first zoo as you and I and regular people imagine. That all started in Vienna in 1752, and it's the beginning of this zoo explosion. Zoos start getting built everywhere from 1752 to 1874 is just like when the zoo became a thing as we understand it. 1874 marks the very first zoo being built in the United States. In what city, Chris? Guess.
Chicago? Might be relevant
to you. You've probably been to this zoo.
I probably have. Was it San Diego?
It's Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. Yeah, you're right. I have been to that one. I didn't realize it was the first one.
The Philadelphia Zoo that is in Philadelphia right now. As of the last time I checked, 2 weeks ago. Yeah, let's be real.
Still there.
Let's hope it's still there. Was the first U.S. zoo. And that also marked the end of people building a lot of zoos. Europe was like, never mind. They have it in Philadelphia. No, thank you.
Yeah, we're done. Go there.
We stop at Grinder City.
Well, I will say this from being at the Philadelphia Zoo. I haven't been there in years, but one of the highlights is they actually have a really good reptile house where they have more room and space for the reptiles. It's actually a really nice expansion they did a bunch of years ago. So check it out.
Like I said, 1806, this is where the Tower of London sort of shuts down. And it's it shuts down to the public. There's still animals there. Because in 1824, the Royal Society...
Wait, where would they get their cats and dogs then?
1824, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was formed. And they went to the Tower of London and said, Jesus Christ, no. And immediately began constructing what is today's London Zoo. Still exists, which was built with the explicit purpose of ensuring that the animals who were brought there were used for the education of the public first, and that their health was the highest priority, that these animals should be alive for the extent of their natural lifespan. So if lions live for 25 years, then the average age of a lion dying in the London Zoo should be roughly 25 years, give or take, for whatever.
Well, better late than never.
Yeah. So, yeah. Just 600
years. 600 years, yeah. And then they finally got there.
So, today. So that's the long story of where the zoo comes from. But today, Chris, if you were to put one animal in your mind and say, oh, yeah, this is like the symbol of the zoo in the 21st century, the one that gets national news coverage, the only animal that gets national news coverage, if one of them shows up in your local zoo, even if your local zoo is in the middle of nowhere, what's that adorable non-aquatic creature in your mind?
I'm thinking a panda bear.
Yeah, panda bears. The panda bear. So what's really interesting is the panda bear is the most appropriate animal to be that symbol of this zoo as a concept, because the panda is really, its story is the same story as zoos, except there was no point in time in which someone conquered a country and brought a bunch of pandas and then ate them 6 months later.
Not yet.
Never say never. So pandas are the biggest draw for zoos in the world. There is no question about that. There are currently, and this is again as about 2 weeks ago, 728 pandas in breeding centers and zoos around the world, which you might think, okay, 728, that's a good number, is wild to think, because 50 years ago, before we really started having pandas in zoos around the world, there were fewer than 700 pandas in the world. So the panda bear almost went extinct in the 1960s. And since having panda bears in zoos, the breeding programs, as well as some reforestation and some wildlife preservation acts, now there's 728 bears in, quote, captivity, but there are 1,500 panda bears in the wild. So, like you said, okay, I don't like really seeing animals in cages, but also, we have saved the panda bear from extinction. So,
right.
Tricky. Mm-hmm. But the panda is, of course, the national animal of China. It's also the logo of the World Wildlife Federation.
Yes.
Which has been a big deal for, like, panda brand awareness. The WWF, the real WWF. Sorry, Mr. McMahon. And I don't know, is she vice president now? What's Lady McMahon's job?
Possibly, but she's also, you know, head of like education as she's dismantling it.
That's right. Secretary of Education.
As she's eliminating her own, you know, department. What's interesting is it's like, I remember when that whole debacle kind of happened where like, oh, the WWF is suing the WWF, the conservation company is going after this massive corporation of wrestling. There's no way they're going to win. And they did. They won the copyright.
They won the copyright
or the trademark.
They established the WWF in 1961, and McMahon didn't establish the WWF until sometime in the 70s. So like, sorry, buddy, you're too late.
Yeah.
The panda that is the symbol of the WWF is actually specifically Chi-Chi. who was a panda that arrived at the London Zoo in 1961. And the founders saw this panda at the zoo and said, that's it. That's the symbol. Look at those eyes. Look at those deep, quote, deep soulful eyes, actually. And it's an endangered species. So it's like, it's perfect. It's the symbol of what the WWF wants to do, but also, goddamn, it's adorable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, no one can go, oh, panda bears, they're really ugly. No, they're absolutely adorable. It's like a koala.
If anyone says something bad about panda bears, they are doing it for clicks. It is a hot take on purpose.
Yeah.
Now, you may be surprised to know that the first time the Western world ever saw a panda was in 1929, when the two sons of Teddy Roosevelt hunted and killed a panda bear in China and took a picture of its carcass that was then sent out to newspapers around the world.
Wow, I did not know that either.
Yeah. God damn.
How was it received, those pictures?
People were into it. People were into it.
Really?
So, all right. So, remember Teddy Roosevelt?
Yeah.
One of our more insane presidents.
Head of the Rough Riders.
Yep. Crazy old Teddy Roosevelt. So, he was also known as a big game hunter. Like, he'd go hunt rhino or lions and stuff. And so, his sons were carrying that tradition. And 1929 is sort of the end of that big game expedition time period where explorers are going out and finding exotic animals.
The Adventurers Club, all of that kind of mythos around those.
Oh, yeah. Ugh. And a bunch of other societies that I'm sure are lovely people in them. I'm sure all of them are great. So the panda only existed in myth as far as anyone was concerned. So for them to go and hunt and get, like, here it is, the carcass of a panda, that's when the US, the UK, and some other parts of Europe suddenly became obsessed with, ooh, pandas are real. The Roosevelt boys killed one.
Wow. What a great validation that they're real. Here's a carcass that we have a picture of. Is it the equivalent of, like, you know, a UK hunter coming back with a unicorn? Is that the kind of thing, like, that people thought?
You're not far off. Like, there were so many people who were like, it's a hoax. It's just some other kind of bear. And they were like, no, we've mounted it. You can come look at this thing. Like, here's the, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had all these stories about how ferocious it was, which is, of course, hilarious. The dumbest bear of all of the bears. And immediately some people were upset about it. Like, really rich woman, a socialite named Ruth Harkness. I have, the script says socialist Naomi, I realize. It's socialite. Very different from socialists. I don't know why maybe autocorrect thought I was writing something different. Anyway, wealthy socialite Ruth Harkness was upset because they killed the bear. So she then launched like four expeditions to China, successfully bringing back the first panda cub to the West in 1936. Hmm. So there's all these newsreels from 1936 of her with this little baby panda and like a bottle of milk feeding the baby panda that took the world by storm. Everyone was like, oh my God, so adorable. All right, so Chris, the panda becomes a thing that the West is excited by. It's a cute little baby that you can apparently bottle feed, or it's a trophy for a president's son. What about China, right? Because they're all from China. So which Chinese leader do you think is the first one to say, let's send some pandas out into the world? Let's care about preserving these pandas.
That one's got me stumped. I don't that one I have no idea.
I would have no idea how to answer
Mao
that question.
Mao Zedong?
Mao Zedong, indeed, is the communist leader who was the first one. That's right. 1st of October, 1949, Mao proclaims the formation of the People's Republic of China, right? We're going to take a little detour. as to why he cared so much about pandas. When he did that and China became a communist country, it underwent like a lot of very significant changes in a very short period of time. So the time period of that decade is often framed by what's called the Great Leap Forward, where China attempted to radically industrialize the nation by building up its heavy industries. So steel production, for example. Fun fact, largest producer of steel in the world today is China. So China tries to go through rapid industrialization. What usually happens, this is a common story, is when you try to make those really quick shifts in a period of a decade, the labor has to come from somewhere to execute that. And for China, that meant peasants. People left farms to go into factories, but they didn't do anything effective to make sure that enough food was being made. So China experiences something like three famines in the 1950s.
Wow.
Which
it's
are
like there was a choice too. Like, would you rather be a farmer or work in a factory? Like, you can pick.
No. It was you're going to the factory, and then someone would be like, but our rice crop, like, it'll be fine. Everyone will be fine. And then it wasn't. So what most countries would do in a situation in which you don't have enough food is that you would buy it
from other countries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? China had a little bit of a problem with that too. So when Nikita Khrushchev became the dictator of the Soviet Union, premier, I don't want to offend my Soviet Union fans out there. When he became the premier of the Soviet Union, we have something called the Sino-Soviet split, which is just that China and Soviet Union had been friends and now they weren't friends because Mao thought that Khrushchev was too liberal in his approaches and he wasn't Stalin enough for Mao's taste. Which is just, good Christ. It's rough. So when they split, when China was like, no, we don't like the Soviet Union anymore, basically all the other communist countries, except for Albania, all turned their back on China. Only Albania was friends with China from about 1954 until the early 1960s. It's the Cold War, which you may remember the end of the Cold War, but you've probably learned about it in history class. The U.S. isn't going to help anybody. And if you're communist, right, we're going to try to launch a long protracted war in your country to defeat whatever communist agents are there, regardless of the costs to humanity. So China doesn't have any options. They don't have anywhere they can buy the grain. And they've got something like 200,000 people a year starving to death. Bad. So Mao had an idea. He was going to break with Marxist tradition, and he was going to begin purchasing grain from capitalist countries in exchange for heavy industry goods that those countries already had but could use more of, right? And to sweeten the pot, he was going to play on the mythologized, mystical perspective that Westerners had of China and had had of China for centuries at this point. And he remembered when he was a kid that Ruth Harkness had that little baby panda and everyone lost their mind and wanted Chinese stuff. So he decided he was going to invent something called panda diplomacy. So when he reaches out to Australia and Canada in 1961 mm-hmm. and says, we want grain, we will give you steel. He also said, here's a panda.
Sweeten the deal.
Yeah. Sweetens the deal with a panda and goes, you guys can have one of these, actually two panda bears. And it worked. Like both Canada and Australia pissed the US off hard by accepting these deals. But like the Sydney Zoo and the Vancouver Zoo were like, yeah, but we get panda bears. Like that's pretty cool.
Yeah, come on. I mean, we got pandas, you know. I know, you know, communism and all, but seriously, look how cute they are.
Yeah. It is, I mean, you're trying to be funny, but this is seriously what they were thinking. Like, they're just legit like, ooh, but we get panda bears. And it's not like the trade deal they were making was a bad deal. Like, these are both expanding countries. Mm-hmm. Burgeoning middle classes, they need steel, they can't keep production up high enough, it's very expensive to buy it from the United States or Germany, or excuse me, West Germany at the time. So like, it makes a lot of sense. So it works. Like, panda bears saved the, like, potentially millions of Chinese people from starving. Wow. Like, by the middle of the decade, China's agriculture output starts to normalize. It starts to increase, partially because everyone's actually getting enough calories in a day to actually go work on a farm with their Australian grain. Hmm. It starts to correct in that way. But also, a year later, they send a panda bear, Chi-Chi, to London as a part of another trade negotiation with the UK. So instead of grain and steel, what China actually did was they wanted to just open an embassy in London. London and the People's Republic of China, or excuse me, UK and the People's Republic of China, really tense relations from the establishment of the PRC until 1961. Because Britain, of course, had colonies in Hong Kong, Singapore, Macau, a couple other bits and bobs all around China. And China was like, we don't like that. You shouldn't be there. That's China. That belongs to us. So in sending a panda bear, which Queen Elizabeth apparently received, maybe. I don't have any pictures of it, though. So I was like, I would see a photo. I don't buy that. I don't believe that that's what happened. But in sending the panda bear over, that was China's opening of the door, and it worked. They got an embassy, and that's actually where the whole 1996 handover of Hong Kong was formalized, is as a direct result of sending Chi-Chi to the London Zoo.
Wow. So panda diplomacy was super effective.
Super effective. Hella effective. People fucking love it. Every country in the world gets a little bit excited when China says, all right, we got a couple of panda bears. We'll let you have some. So that normalization with relations to the UK changes, like, the world. Like, China being the first time that one of the major powers of the communist side of the Iron Curtain was able to normalize relations with, you know, not the US, but the UK is like, you know, second place in terms of Western powers at that point. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a huge shift. And it paved the way in 1972 for the arrival of Ling Ling and Sing Sing, who were, of course, received by Pat Nixon when Nixon went to China after, of course, his goblin. He sent his goblin first, who shall not be named. Thank God he's dead. He sent that guy first, but then Nixon and his wife, Patricia Pat, showed up in China. And when they got there, there was two pandas for Pat Nixon, who brought him back to the Smithsonian Zoo in Washington, D.C., where they would live out about 10 years, I think. And the United States was charmed from that point forward. So, ever since then, this policy has been in place, right? Every time you see that China is establishing some sort of a significant diplomatic or economic relationship with a country, there's a panda involved somewhere.
Wow. Still?
Still.
But this is such a good deal for China then. This is like, it's crazy much it does for the economy.
Cost them nothing. Like, they send a couple of bears, a couple of dumb bears which they have now 1,500 of in the wild. So it's not like they're, you know, there's not a shortage of them, but actually technically there is a shortage of them. Like they're not endangered anymore, but they're still vulnerable.
But
they're vulnerable to trade negotiations.
Yeah. Is the benefit for the country that receives it the tourism? Is that what they're getting from it?
Well, the benefit comes in a couple of different things. One is that, yes, tourism. Like when a panda or a breeding pair of pandas show up at a zoo, that zoo's like it's something like a 400% increase in ticket sales or foot traffic, depending on how the zoo measures success. You know, donations tend to go up as well. You know, merch sales obviously go through the roof.
Enough of something completely unrelated.
You should see the Ling Ling like merch from the 70s. You remember like old 70s t-shirts that look like the iron-on logos you would put on there? I don't know.
I remember those. Yeah.
Yeah. That there's so many of those from the early 70s that are just panda bears that are like super, super off brand. Like you're sort of like, I guess if you squint, it's a panda bear.
It's like going to a concert and then, you know, in the parking lot, you know, like, oh, this doesn't look like Coldplay, but I guess it's a Coldplay shirt.
Yeah, just guys standing outside of the zoo with bootleg t-shirts. Oh, $3 for $5. So yes, that's number one, but also it creates a media storm. So for example, in 2017 at the G20, Xi Jinping brought pandas for Berlin. And even though he didn't say anything about this, the European news media was like, China is anointing Germany as the successor to the United States as the dominant leader of Western nations after trade negotiations between China and the Trump administration fall apart. You're like, holy shit. So it was good for the German economy for like 6 weeks that they got that boost. Of course, the funny thing is, China can also take pandas away, and then that creates trouble. And this happened twice in the United States, 2010 and 2023. So that's, by the way, keep track, everybody. That's Obama and that's Joe Biden. So Democrats, they love losing pandas.
Okay? Pandas have Chinese repo men?
Yes. Pandas absolutely have Chinese repo men. The four pandas that were taken away from U.S. zoos were because both presidents had the Dalai Lama come over.
Oh, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That'll do the trick.
You have to have a llama or a panda, one or the other.
Oh, that's perfect.
The two should never meet.
No, they can't occupy the same space. You know, it's like Catan. You can't get sheep and wheat. You've got to pick one. So those pandas, by the way, they're not donations. They are on loan to these zoos. So you sign either a 10 or 15 year loan. And then, yes, at the end of that loan, some dudes show up and they take the panda back to China, where it is usually rewilded. Now, I say usually rewilded with a bit of a squint in my face because no one, like, there's no international organizations that observe what happens. Mm-hmm. And, like, pandas all look, like, there's no way to know. Like, it's not like they say, oh, yeah, we've tagged them and released them back into this particular zone, and you can track what happens to them. They just go, yeah, we put them back in the wild.
Yeah.
And you're like,
you never know. I'm just wondering if, like, the panda repo men show up in black and white suits, which would be kind of cool.
You know, that would be good if they, I'll tell you what, if This was Japan and not China, 100%. Not only would they show up in black and white suits, but they would also have like a nice cartoon logo, and like the van would like play a little jingle that's like the panda theme song or something. But it's China, and I gotta say, they probably just show up in gray uniforms and are just the most humorless bastards you've ever met in your life. Something about communist regimes. They just make people not very good at comedy. Except for Yakov Smirnov, please.
Communist regimes, bad costumes. Result in bad costumes.
Part of the terms of these loans, though, is that people have to pay fees to China. Now, Chris, you want to guess? How much does it cost to rent a panda? What's your mortgage on a panda costing per year, per zoo, per panda?
Well, I thought this was part of like a trade deal, so it was kind of like included. Now, if it's an extra fee, it's probably like thousands of dollars a year.
Okay, thousands of dollars a year. Add some zeros. $1 million a year.
Wow.
Every zoo in the world that is not in China that has a panda bear pays $1 million a year, roughly, per panda bear. So if you've got a breeding pair, that's $2 million a year.
Wow.
How much are these zoos making?
By the way, I have had that thought several times during this research. I'm like, should I start a zoo? Yeah. Was Matt Damon right all along? Like, this seems quite lucrative.
Because that's definitely has to go into the yearly operating budget. Or like, well, panda, you know, licensing fee.
Yeah. Panda licensing fee is a line item on the budget for the Edinburgh Zoo just down the road. If the breeding pair produces a cub, that cub is legally the property of the People's Republic of China, and the zoo has to pay a $400,000 birth fee to the PRC, which is insane.
I would be neutering my panda.
Well, like, is that now after the birth fee, then does that new panda also cost $1 million a year too?
Once it hits a certain age, you have to send it back to China for it to reach adulthood in one of their breeding centers. And then it goes into the rotation, I guess, of pandas that get shipped out to other zoos around the world. So it's a one-time fee. You get a baby panda for a couple of years. And like, of course, as soon as you get the baby panda, if you think footfall goes up, ticket sales go up when breeding pairs show up, baby panda is ka-ching, ka-ching for every zoo out there.
That's the zoo rainmaker.
Exactly. Well, as I say, zoos will be like, we've had a tough couple of years. You know, it's not been going well. But, you know, Chi-Chi's pregnant, so we're gonna get there, guys. We just got to get to November. Additionally, panda bears must be fed a bamboo diet. But it cannot be any bamboo because China will not allow it to be any bamboo. So you must buy the bamboo from China to the tune of $500,000 per panda per year in bamboo costs. So if you have two pandas and they have a baby and you're a zoo, you're looking at about just $3.5 million, roughly, dollars in that year that baby panda is born. In panda fees alone.
It's a lot of ticket sales to make that up.
Yeah, you're gonna need a lot.
China's got such a good scheme here.
Yes.
They're just raking in the cash and that someone's looking after their pandas for them.
Yep.
Can't we do that with bald eagles or something here? I feel like there's something we could emulate.
Why don't we send them some of our Welsh dragons or something?
Well, if Eric Trump could be photographed with the carcass of a dragon, I think maybe we could get this party started. So remember, there's 728 pandas in zoos around the world. So to the Chinese economy, panda bears, just as an export, is $1 billion a year industry. Not to mention that inside of China, those zoos and breeding centers. So I read it. I got a study in the show notes. It's from 2018. And it shows that anywhere there is a zoo within China or breeding center within China or wildlife preserve with panda populations, all metrics of quality of life increase across the board. Median household income up an average of 14%. Life expectancy, 3 years on average longer. Like health conditions, like visits to hospitals down like 20%. So inside of China, the panda bears are also super important for the economy. So much so that, and this is where Chris, I'm sure you'll be excited to know, did you think it was weird that they made a fourth Kung Fu Panda movie?
No, I actually didn't think that was weird at all.
I thought it was weird because I thought the trilogy kind of wrapped it up. And there's quite a gap between Kung Fu Panda 3 and Kung Fu Panda 4.
If they make money, they're going to keep making them. I mean, how many Jurassic Park movies have we had?
Anyway, so that sent me down a dark path. Kung Fu Panda 4, half of the budget comes from Chinese studios because they were like, DreamWorks, make another Kung Fu Panda. And DreamWorks was like, I think we did all the, I mean, sure, but we got to convince the team to get back together, you know, to make this happen. And China was like, you will make it happen. Because Kung Fu Panda 4 is like the third highest grossing film in China of like all time.
Wow.
China was very insistent. And apparently they may or may not have also spent some money to buy some of those animators in order to make their Ne Zha 2, which came out this year and is the highest grossing movie in the whole world right now of 2025 at $1.9 billion. And neither of you have seen it.
I saw the first one, actually. I haven't seen the sequel.
No, because you can't see the sequel. I have no
idea what that is.
Correct. Because it only came out in China, Naomi.
Oh.
It made almost $2 billion and it only came out in China.
Is it about pandas?
No. Oh. No. But it's an animated film.
I don't care then.
Yeah. Yeah, the first one ended up on Netflix. So we're able to see it here.
I think it has a contract with Bilibili in China, an exclusivity contract first. And they're probably localizing it for the English speaking audience as we speak. And then when that expires, it'll be Bilibili? No, it's one of the, I don't care. These are Chinese streaming services. So yeah, the panda business is continuing the trend of zoos, just like Henry III in England invented the zoo, basically, as we understand it. And it opened up England to all these, you know, these foreign entities trying to send their animals, just like Hatshepsut 3,500 years ago, used the zoo as proof of the conquest and ability to take on external countries. The panda bear's entire story is just picking that tradition up and running with it. We only know about them because China needed them to make their diplomacy work at a time in which diplomacy was very difficult for them. And honestly, they are never beneficial to the country that receives them in any way, shape, or form. No zoo, with a couple of exceptions, San Diego being one of them, has really made money off of pandas. They are only beneficial to the country that is receiving them, not the zoo. Their cost is so much, but it's such a distraction, and it helps build relationships with China, which is the second largest economy in the world. And that is really at the heart of why we freak out about panda bears all the time. That, and of course, they're objectively quite adorable. I mean,
yes,
they're big, silly blob creatures.
Do you think, like, because of the cost and because of the benefit to the country, some of the countries actually give government subsidies to the zoos that are panda specific?
Yes. So Australia does that. There was a big debate about it actually here in the UK, because Edinburgh was actually having some troubles and the Scottish government has given some subsidies. I know they did the same in like Finland for sure, or Norway, Scandinavia. But not the United States. No, no, no. The Smithsonian Zoo in Washington, of course, is owned by the government. So like it is a federal institution. But San Diego's gotten nothing from California or the federal government, but that's San Diego. It's kind of a unique entity. And actually, I think there's at least one zoo in the States that may have gone bankrupt because of the pandas. But that is, again, I looked into it. I don't see like a clear, yes, that's what happened. But given the expenses, as we just established, like, yeah, it's probably what happened. So that's our little journey. We just took a little journey through zoos and panda bears and how it's really weird that global diplomacy hinges on bears. Chris, could you tell the audience what's something you learned today? What's some things that you picked up today that maybe you didn't know earlier?
That there's a shadow there's a shadow bear trade diplomacy method that China uses over the years that I had no idea that, you know, it was so specifically tied to trade and other nations, the panda bear trade.
Yeah, it's a truly, it was, I think this was the quickest turnaround I've ever had from conceiving of an episode to doing the research to writing the script. Because I think
sent me a thing about it, and then I was like, "Please, it needs to be an episode. That's really mad." And you were like, "I'm writing it now." And then I had the notes within in a few days.
Yeah. Originally, I was going to do an episode about the LA Dodgers and racism, but I thought, you know what? Let's have fun. And the last two episodes have been about America anyway. So folks out there, if you, like Chris, learned something about panda bears today you didn't know, secret dark market cabals of panda bear trades, then you should subscribe to this show, because this is what we do every other week. And you're listening to it right now in an app that has a button that says subscribe. Just click on that button. That's the easiest way to get to the show. You can support us that way, and you can learn other weird things that we talk about, like, oh, what's an animal? Oh, Hello Kitty, of course, stopping a sex trafficking ring. We did that one. Or how the Shinkansen, the bullet train is based on birds. Fun fact. It's just a bunch of birds cobbled together into a machine. We talk about that in detail. And if you really like us, we have a Patreon for just $2 a month. You can get an extra episode. And right now, one of the most recent episodes, it's going to be a quiz. That was a lot of fun.
I get absolutely thrashed.
Yeah.
In my knowledge of word games, it was quite embarrassing.
Very, very good and fun. So that's just at patreon.com/seemingly unrelated. And Chris, where can everyone find you?
Yeah, you can find me at whitecatentertainment.com, and we actually have a new Kickstarter that's going next month called Alpha Cats. It's not a panda, but it is a cat in space. It's kind of like a Star Trek meets Ratchet and Clank. That's kind of an all ages fun kind of like space adventure with animals, insects, robots, and mystery and adventure. So I wanted to try my hand at like a little bit younger audience. So I wanted to. That'll be launching next month. So you can check that out on Kickstarter as well, Alpha Cat.
Now, next month, of course, we're recording this in September.
Okay, but so the episode, sorry, so October.
Okay, so the episode will premiere on the, I believe, 4th of November. So is there any time left on that Kickstarter is the question.
Yes, it'll go to mid-November.
Okay, so you've got time, gang. You got like 10 days. Get in there. Get some Alpha Cats. Thanks so much for being on the show, Chris. We really appreciate you reaching out.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great to reconnect, and I learned a lot, and great meeting you, Naomi. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so much fun. Thank you for coming on.
And gang, we'll see you in 2 more weeks for more Seemingly Unrelated Madness. Goodbye to you.
Bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone, audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Cohn. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seeminglyunrelatedpod.com.
So now Chris is gone, we've just decided to watch a video of a panda falling over. It felt unprofessional while he was here.
I would love to hear his reaction to that. He's probably going to be mad, actually.
He's missing all the fun. Okay, are you ready?
Yeah.
Oh, it's got fun music.
I know. Oh, that one went down. Oh, boy. Some of these look...
I can't actually hear you because it's so loud.
Oh, really? I can just mute the music, actually. Let's do this. Yeah. Some of the falls look painful. They look dangerous. And then other ones are kind of... Like, that one's cute and cuddly. That's just silly. I don't know.
They're just so floppy. They just fold. They just fold into a little... Panda these, puddle.
These are, of course, panda cubs falling down. Oh. That wasn't a fall. He sat down. Toronto Zoo, these are lies.